Good morning, everybody. Welcome to this Tuesday edition of the Roundtable and our panel discussion on this 19th of May. The month is flying, and we thank you very much for being with us. We have a lot to talk about with, just three incredible panelists. So let me introduce them, and then we'll...
Is there another panel coming in, Jim?
That was a shot at me, wasn't it?
We're all looking around, actually.
That's right.
You know.
There's windows in here. I'm looking in the other studios.
You know. That was a shot.
I think you have the wrong script.
That was not a shot.
Joe,
that was very true. I feel very good about all of you and what you're going to bring to the program.
I love all my children.
That's right. Absolutely. Let me introduce you. Of course, Alan Shartok is here. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, and I'm very happy. I'll tell you about it because all of a sudden some real money is coming into the
lockbox. Cascading.
Yeah.
What's it, 2 weeks from today?
Yeah.
2 weeks from yesterday, Mike.
Yeah. Yesterday.
Yeah. Yikes. So we'll tell you about that.
Well said.
A little bit about 9:33-ish. We'll bring it up to date on that.
20 minutes.
That's right. Thank you, Blair. And big hand on the... Yeah. Also joining us is NYPERG's Blair Horner. Good morning, Blair.
Good morning, Joe.
Very nice to have you here. And as normally is the case on Tuesday, Times Union Associate Editor Mike Spain joins us. Good morning, Mike.
Good morning.
Very nice to have you with us. And a reminder, you can join us any old time at WAMC.org. Go right on today's panel post, which is 5/19/15, today's date, and post your thoughts there. Or you can email them directly to us, WAMC.org/roundtable.
And while you're there, you'll see a big lockbox there on the right-hand side of the page. Just tap on that and put something in.
Free it.
Right.
That's right.
I like it.
Free the lockbox.
Right. So here's the thing. We enjoy doing the panel. We enjoy doing the show. And we want there to be as many shows as possible. So if we shorten the fund drive, then you get more shows.
That's a very good point.
If the fund drive is longer, then you lose all your programming. So all we're trying to do is, you know, pack the car before we get ready for the trip.
And also provide money for the gas.
That's right. That's right. And hit up your college friends for the gas for the trip. Let's go on and talk about some of the stories that are making news this morning. We have several interesting things to talk about. And I don't normally do this, but does anybody have, is there a request? Does anybody have, would you like to start?
I thought Mike's, the Albany Times Union, the Times Union, ran a very interesting story about the plight of the College of St. Rose this morning. And the reason it's an important story is it is not only about St. Rose, obviously. It's about every institution of higher education in the country. You know, you hire a professor to do something in their specialty, and you pay them $100,000, somebody's going to have to pick up that slack. I'm not saying that all salaries are $100,000, but many of them are.
Now, being an adjunct faculty member, I will recuse myself from this part of the conversation. I'll let you all discuss it, and I'll check my email to see if I still have a job there.
Well, our story by D'Artonaro Clark is about the College of St. Rose, but I think, Alan, you said it. It's the crisis that's particularly difficult for smaller private colleges, and that is a declining enrollment pool. And because of that, they're facing some financial problems, and they're going to eliminate 40 positions and cut employee benefits and retirement packages. And they have a plan. Now, the new president at the College of St. Rose, Carolyn Stefanko, who's really only been there about a year, is hitting this problem that was really in place when she arrived. And she's 23 of the positions that they're eliminating are actually going to be people let go, and 17 are going to be our positions that are vacant right now. On top of that, they're going to have a sliding scale on how they reduce benefits, and which I think is an enlightened approach. The people making less will not see a cut in their health care benefits, but people who are higher up on the scale will proportionally have to pay more of their health care. But what we're really talking about here is a college that has traditionally taught teachers. And that has been a big part of their student body, both in undergraduate and graduate schools. A lot of teachers in the Capital Region go and get their 30 credits to maintain their licenses, and a lot of people go and get their master's there while they're working. And there's fewer people going into teaching, which, you know, Blair, I'm sure at the state capitol you're familiar with the cuts to education and some of the politics, Alan, that sure. Is discouraging young people from choosing that path. It's a difficult job, and it's a difficult to get a job. But if we don't train new teachers, we're going to have problems in our society. But College of St. Rose, like a lot of other colleges, has expanded their recruitment over the last few years. They've gone around the country. They've gone abroad to try to bring in, you know, paying students to cover the costs. They don't have a large endowment like your Ivy League, so they can't just dip in and finance everybody's. They do offer financial aid, but it does come out of the bottom line. So it's always a dicey situation. And again, as I think you said, Alan,
I did.
It is not simply a story about the College of St. Rose. It's a college. Just think about all the small private and the small Catholic colleges that are sprinkled across New York and New England, and they all are having to deal with this. It's a demographic issue as much as anything else.
Well, you know, Blair knows an awful lot of people at the in the public sector, too. I have to tell you, having taught at New Paltz in Albany for 40 years, I can tell you that we have lived through these times at the State University also. And one of the things that happens, and by the way, none of these positions, as I read that story, are faculty. They are all people who are support services one way or the other. But I've been there at State University when they put a freeze on everything. That's the first thing they do. Put everybody, you can't hire a guy, which is fine until the German department, the one guy they have or the two guys they have, are out. Right. You know, they retire. And now you have none. So it hits unfairly when you put these freezes on.
Mm-hmm. Well, and the whole, to some extent, the business model of higher education is changing, too. Increasingly relying on adjuncts.
Exactly.
Joe's collective sigh of relief over here when you mentioned academics not being let go at St. Rose. But they said more focus on adjuncts, more online classes, which moves away from brick-and-mortar sort of institutions. The changing population in terms of the state. You have more and more kids that are non-traditional, and so they're going to much more likely to go to private public colleges than private. And so for the small, traditional, liberal arts colleges sprinkled across the Northeast, they have a serious problem in terms of their long-term prospects. And they don't have the endowments, as Mike mentioned, they don't have the endowments in terms of to sort of buffer the whatever transition has to occur from what they are now to something in the future.
Yeah, and another aspect of this is, I think you alluded to, is that the state university system, the public university system, Nancy Zimpfer has looked at expanding the student, the size of the student body through the next 15 years so that they can grow in order to sustain the public university system. And where are those students going to come from? They're going to be competing with the private colleges and offering lower tuitions that are taxpayer subsidized in their efforts to grow. And it's just going to make it even more difficult for these small colleges to attract students. So that's why they're using different strategies. They're changing course offerings. They're trying to differentiate, and there'll probably be a lot of partnerships between these private colleges.
I missed that part.
Probably be private partnerships.
Partnerships.
A lot of partnerships between.
My hearing is so bad. I thought
a lot
I heard
of P words in a row.
I thought I heard
probably private partnerships.
I thought I heard.
I think you're going to see a lot of colleges and regions sharing some of the. Already do. I mean, I think there are these kinds of. Programs.
But not to worry, because the governor is now going to bring people into the state university. This is a shot, by the way. into the state university for tax free purposes, so that they can have, so that they can set up businesses and turn the SUNY campuses into more of a, thing.
You're referring to the Startup New York program.
I am.
That lures businesses into relationships with colleges and in
so far a very small number.
Which Tom DiNapoli,
the New York Times reported this week, right? That it's a handful, 30. something like that.
As soon as Tom DiNapoli did that, we began to hear reports all of the audit showing how badly that thing is working. We began to hear all kinds of reports about how Tom DiNapoli is running for governor, which is nonsense. That's his job.
In fairness, the governor's people say that, you know, when you're talking about entrepreneurial jobs, it starts out slow, but it takes a while to get going. And it's beginning to take hold, they say, and we'll see in the future whether they are right or not.
That's what I love about you. Always give the other side.
That's right.
All right. Let's take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll talk about other topics. And we welcome your comments. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Roundtable at WAMC.org. We'll be right back.
Support comes from Wild Birds Unlimited Nature Shop, Saratoga Springs, New York, helping to bring nature closer with Eagle Optics, Vortex, Swarovski, and Zeiss binoculars and spotting scopes. 518-226-0071. Hampshire Veterinary Hospital, corner of University Drive and Route 9 in Amherst, Massachusetts, reminding listeners that keeping ticks off the body is essential for prevention of Lyme disease. HampVet.com. And Cultural Pittsfield, featuring Third Thursday, a creative youth theme, Thursday 5 p.m. to 8 p.m. rain or shine in downtown Pittsfield. DiscoverPittsfield.com.
Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and our panel discussion this morning. Alan Shartok, Mike Spain, Blair Horner, I'm Joe Donahue, and we welcome you to our conversation, Roundtable at WAMC.org. Let's go to the biker story. This is really still, we're kind of figuring out what happened on Sunday, but there are, from what I understand, these two motorcycle gangs in Texas, and probably more, but the two involved in this
Five at this particular summit, but two of them decided to slug it out.
That's right. So the Bandidos and the Cossacks. And they are warring tribes, and they both originate in Texas. They go back to the 1960s and have long had this feud, which obviously boiled over at the Twin Peaks restaurant in Waco, Texas, the site of the shootout that took place on Sunday. Now we learn yesterday that 170 bikers have been charged in this incident where there have been nine fatalities, nine bikers dead, 18 others wounded.
Yeah, the story that I was looking at some of the stories in the Texas newspapers to see their perspective. And the Houston Chronicle says they were armed with knives, chains, and more than a few guns as these renegade biker gangs fought to a gory death of nine men and raising the fear that there's going to be a vendetta against Texas law enforcement personnel in weeks to come. And that's a serious threat, I guess, that police are worried there's going to be some kind of retribution from the bikers that weren't arrested, you know, other than the 170 that were arrested after this incident in Waco. But it's pretty scary.
Yeah, I mean, this story seems less about bikers and more about organized crime. I mean, the story is about the Bandidos, which is sort of a cartoon name, you know, sort of, you know, think of them as sort of these sort of heinous characters, basically believe that they control the state of Texas. And that the Cossacks...
Don't come on my turf.
That's right. And the Cossacks have to pay, you know, some sort of fealty to them. And they were expecting, I guess, some sort of payment of some sort from the Cossacks for allowing them to operate in the state of Texas, which the Bandidos control. So that smacks more like, you know, like street gangs, organized crime, mafia families than it does. And they just happen to ride motorcycles. I mean, that's more like what the story's about. And the fact that in the middle of the day on a Sunday, they're at a strip mall loaded with all sorts of weapons. And the police know that there's going to be a problem. They have a SWAT team there with a bunch of police officers. I mean, this was just really, it's almost like out of the movie Scarface, right? It's this crazy sort of setup where people are armed to the teeth, ready to do battle. The police are there, and of course, battle ensues. And they just happen to ride motorcycles.
Yeah, and one of the chiefs said, or DA, and I forget who, that this is not a bunch of lawyers and doctors on their Harleys. These are criminals on their bikes.
That's a good point, because here in the Capital Region, in the next few weeks, we're going to see Harley Davidsons going up the Northway to Lake George for the annual Harley Rendezvous, and those are families. And
Americade.
That's right. Not the Harley Rendezvous, the Americade. Right. That's another gathering that used to happen in this region, no longer does, but the Americade. And there is. It's a great tradition, motorcycling, but. I should point out that the bikers and their lawyers and their supporters say that the constitutional rights of many of the club members are constantly under assault by law enforcement authorities, and they're accusing the authorities of harassing them because they are such a visible presence, because they are conspicuous in their disdain and in distrust of the police and agents of the Bureau of Alcohol,
and they carry guns and brass knuckles and knives to meetings that they go to in the middle of the day on a Sunday. They're being harassed.
They have a spokesman. I mean, they have spokespeople.
Well, again, it's like a scene out of The Godfather, right?
Well,
I mean, consigliere there to defend them.
I was taking some of our panel members to task yesterday for maligning the state of Texas. However, I do have to say that having spent some time in Texas, when you go to the mall, there's a lot of weaponry. People are wearing their weapons. I mean, that is legal. That is part of the culture of the state.
Well, the restaurant itself is a part of a chain known for scantily clad waitresses.
Maybe not for long.
Yes, they seem to be having some problems there in the marketing department.
They're in trouble too, right?
However, we did get Joe, a letter from Bob. Has anybody noticed that there have been no illegal weapons charges lodged against the bikers? That's because in Texas, everybody is entitled to carry guns.
Yeah.
Gee, what could go wrong?
Well, I remember when I was in, we were just going to the Gap. And I pick up a T-shirt because I forgot to pack one. There's just like these two people in front of me, and they both are packing heat. And you're like, oh, all right. And smoking, I should add.
Well, they could have a shootout at any time, apparently. I mean, so that certainly makes it worse, right?
But if
you assume that this is really about criminality and not about bikers, they just happen to ride motorcycles and they're really sort of organized crime operation, because all the articles that I read talked about them being involved in drug trafficking and all these other sorts of serious crimes. Again, we don't know anything about these particular individuals, but that's what the story is about the Bandidos and the Cossacks and the others.
So I have about 5 seconds, but go ahead.
All right, well, then I'll just stop right there.
I'll pause you, and then we'll come back, and we'll discuss this in just a moment. We'll be back. We're going to take a quick break with news and then more. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We still have Blair Horner on pause, but I will depress that button in just a moment to continue our conversation. Before we do, though, we want to get an update on our lockbox and find out how that is doing, because I realize there's very good news to report, and we want to get to that. Reminder, you can go to WAMC.org to help the lockbox. And Megan, what do you got? No, what do you have to report
well,
to us?
We're doing really good. Things were picking up yesterday. People were pledging online, and we're up to $141,428 in the locked box.
So how much did we do yesterday, do you know?
Over 25,000.
Wow.
Yep, we had a lot in the mail, a lot online. People are, joining in.
So it looks good. So in order to make it, we're going to have to do at least $17,000 a day.
About that,
which should be doable if you think about it, because during a fund drive, we make $100,000, a day.
Yep.
So everybody just... Please, this is Alan speaking. Please,
Yeah, please. We got 13 days to go. We need $233,572 to make the two challenge grants that are on the table. You know, we don't want to lose that $17,500 from First Niagara and from Mr. Big.
And if somebody wants to even incentivize this whole thing a little bit more, we're all ears. We're more than welcome.
Oh, yeah.
Another challenge.
We'll take another challenge.
Yeah, sure.
And all of this obviously shortens the fund drive and makes it a much easier row to hoe. So what's wrong with that, right?
Well, people tell us all the time, actually. I see the comments that come in online. They love the lockbox. They appreciate that it shortens the fund drive. So, you know, we did a great job in February. We had a 3.5-day fund drive. We could do it again.
All right. That is our task.
Thank
WAMC.org, WAMC.org. Megan Finnegan, thank you very much for coming in this morning and sharing the good news with us. We appreciate it. And you can make the news even better for tomorrow. WAMC.org,
please.
WAMC.org. All right. Depress.
Oh, my God. Well, this is the downside to having someone like me on your panel is because my advanced age, I already forgot what I was talking about. We were talking about the bikers.
Yes.
I remember doing my sort of, you know, Al Pacino consigliere element to it. I think I'll leave it at that because I'm sure we want to move on to other stories.
We have a few letters on
Well, let's get to those.
On this
maybe
issue.
Blair will remember what he wanted to say.
Yeah. Richard takes us to task. He says, please stop mixing law-abiding gun ownership and carrying with the actions of criminals, in capital letters, criminals. Your personal dislike of gun ownership is finding its way into the conversation too much today. Legal gun ownership had nothing to do with what happened this week. Do you think these criminals in capital letters really cared about the law when this all happened? Keep the facts straight. Thank you. And that's from Richard. And Glenn, just no content, but it says hoodlums on motorcycles. And Angelique says, please call them thugs. This is a clear case where the word applies. And that's from Angelique in Pittsfield. And then we had some, here from Barbara, little coverage about white on white criminality. Okay. And there are a couple of people who have written and said there's a little problem this morning with some of our broadcasting and that there's a sort of an echo. And I know that our Pat Cooney and his crack engineering staff are on that as we speak. Hold on, folks. We're coming.
I just wanted to mention that the Houston Chronicle describes Waco. It says it may qualify by some measures as any town USA. It has long seemed somewhat out of place. A borrow a cup of sugar over the back fence town dropped awkwardly into the swaggering Texas triangle of Dallas, San Antonio, and Houston. Best known for a Baptist university that once prohibited dancing on campus, the city has worked to draw tourism dollars by building monuments to semi-local glory, from a Dr. Pepper museum to the halls of fame for the Texas Rangers and Texas sports. That's Waco, Texas.
The Dr. Pepper Museum.
Yes, it sounds like a cool place.
That's,
that's great.
Unbelievable.
But they're also where the bikers congregated for this really awful...
I'm a pepper. Yeah. She's a pepper. Mm-hmm. You're a pepper. Wouldn't you like to be a pepper, too? All right.
Well, and just the PS on this, though, we don't even know how this is ultimately going to play out. As Mike mentioned before, there's been some reports that the Bandidos and the Cossacks are asking their affiliates in other states to converge on Waco and, get some retribution for the police, apparently, their involvement in this fight. So, you know, I mean, hopefully this thing sort of calms down, but it is definitely sort of a scary thing when you have hundreds of people driving around armed to the teeth and involved in criminality.
That's exactly right.
And it's not just guns. They have knives and clubs, too.
Brass knuckles.
Yeah.
Apparently somebody was swinging a chain with a lock on it and hitting someone during the fight in the restroom.
Oh, boy.
All right. So let us move on to other issues. And we welcome your comments. Roundtable at WAMC.org, WAMC.org. So I found this to be an interesting story. When the Environmental Protection Agency proposed a major new rule intended to protect the nation's drinking water last year, regulators solicited opinions from the public. The purpose of the public comment, that is in quotations, public comment period, was to objectively gauge Americans' sentiment before changing a policy that could profoundly affect their lives. But critics say there is reason for the overwhelming result that they had, which is this 1 million comments and nearly 90% that favored the agency's proposal Apparently, the EPA had a hand in manufacturing it. In a campaign that tests the limits of federal lobbying law, the agency orchestrated a drive to counter political opposition from Republicans and enlist public support in concert with liberal environmental groups and a grassroots organization aligned with President Obama.
All right. You know, it doesn't appear from what you read in the article that necessarily that any laws were violated. I mean, it was interesting the way it was framed in the article. It was testing the limits of the law. And this law, which passed about 100 years ago, prohibiting the federal government from using its resources to lobby the Congress or other policymakers. Where this, I guess, gets close to the edge on it is that the EPA is basically stimulating public support in support of itself. And so I guess that's the legal distinction they're making. But you can imagine if you're an environmentalist, you might like this, but you can imagine if the administration was ginning up public support for, you know, saying that climate change isn't real, how people would be sort of horrified by this. So it shows, how partisan and political the whole place has become.
You know, it's always been so that there have been prohibitions of one kind or another, either on the state level or the federal level, for getting people to write in from an agency. But as long as I've been in the business, there have been books and things written about how there are ancillary groups. For example, mental health in New York State. I once talked to a guy high up in the Mental Health Administration here who said, if there wasn't the Mental Health Association, I don't know what I would do. So that what happens is that the commissioner or somebody talks to, when there's a bill up, talks to somebody in the association or winks at somebody in the association, and they become the agency that transmits the plea. This goes on all the time.
Well, in this story, though, they're saying that the EPA was using social media like Twitter accounts to get its message out directly to the people. It was maybe not relying on these public interest groups, these support groups that, like the Sierra Club, is not entirely relying on them, but going directly to the public. And that might have been different than lobbying Congress. You go to the public and let the public lobby Congress. So it may be skirting
Although this was about expressing support for the rule that the EPA was putting out, the Congress was considering legislation to sort of stop what the EPA was doing, which is basically, in this context, protecting wetlands and other drinking water supplies. Mm. And that they were – and so it had this sort of collateral benefit on the congressional side, but the target was really about to show that the EPA had public support for its regulations to protect watersheds and other clean water supplies. So it is really tricky, though. You can see it from a lot of different perspectives. And with social media, I mean, the way that the courts have interpreted this, as I understand it, is that the state, the feds can't use substantial resources on grassroots activity, right? And in the social media world, it doesn't really cost much to do anything, right?
And it's so a whole new world.
And that's right. And so when these laws passed and these court interpretations, the most recent one, I guess, was in 2005 that I saw on the New York Times website, you really didn't have the same sort of ease with which you could use a Twitter account or Facebook, which is really doesn't cost that much other than staff time to sort of drive public opinion.
But the heads of the various agencies have always been out there shilling for the administration's point of view. I mean, the head of, you know, the EPA can certainly talk about the administration's stance, or the head of
But there's no prohibition on that.
There's
prohibition was on the grassroots side. Right. And that's where the controversy around this really is generated.
As you say, it costs very little money to.
So will there be fallout? Will anything change?
Well, I assume the opponents of what the EPA is trying to do, because you can see from the accounts, you know, it's the industries, the builders, you know, the farm guys that want to exploit these resources for themselves or build houses on them. They're the ones who are opposed. So they're going to use it. They're using it as a cudgel to beat up the EPA, because they know the public is probably with the EPA, whether or not they were stimulated by the EPA or not.
The next step will be that they'll form a coalition if they don't have one already.
They have one.
And they will, they will use social media and they will use all other
means.
They are doing that.
It felt like when I was reading the article that they were beginning to make the case for litigation down the road, that they're going to be able to try to push the Congress, which is controlled well, not control, but it certainly has a substantial portion of its supporters are opposed to what the EPA is trying to do, try to stimulate them, try to get them more engaged, and perhaps set up litigation down the road by saying what the EPA did violated the law.
But on the other hand, from a political point of view, don't you guys think that the that when you're doing something like this, you have to anticipate what you're going to unleash?
Yes.
You're going to get caught. And I think that that's the point. If you do get caught, what will the fallout be? Will it be worse? Will you give impetus to the Congress passing, you know, a rule saying we don't want this stuff, this progressive stuff, to happen? So I really don't know the answer to that question. But I do know that people all the time do things without thinking about the potential consequences.
But again, as I mentioned, when I was, again, looking at the article, I don't study federal lobbying law closely. This goes back 100 years-ish. Where the federal government was ginning up telegram campaigns in support of some legislation that they wanted the Congress to pass. And so this is a constant thing where the government wants to use its resources to advocate on its own perspective. And so, as I mentioned to Mike, there's no prohibition on agency heads participating or agencies lobbying at the state capitol. That happens all the time. Where you run into these issues is, should taxpayer resources
Meeting
be used
resources.
In sort of a grassroots campaign? And there's clear federal law prohibiting federal dollars from being used at the state level to lobby local governments and state governments. Mm. And these court cases and opinions say that the feds can't do it either. The question is, in this case, they were not targeting the Congress, and they were not targeting some other agency. They were ginning up public support for their own effort. And so that, I think, is where you're in sort of this sort of dancing around, as Joe mentioned in the beginning, that they're testing the limits of the law. And you're right, Alan, they should have anticipated. I guess their calculation was the last thing in the world they wanted was the opponents to dominate the field, and that's why they sort of did it the way they did it.
Could be.
All right, let's take a break. We'll come back and talk about other things. WAMC.org, WAMC.org is where you can go to post your comment on our site and also help out the Walkbox while you're there. And or you can go to roundtable@WAMC.org, roundtable@WAMC.org. We'll be right back.
Support comes from Fleury Lumber, Route 10, East Hampton, providing advice and assistance for projects small and large. Items such as Benjamin Moore paints, hardwood flooring, Anderson windows, Trex decking, tools, lumber, hardware, FleuryLumber.com. United Way of Dutchess Orange Region sponsoring a confidential helpline accessed by dialing 211 that links people to Health and Human Services for everyday needs, UWDOR.org. Myron Wine and Spirits, Kingston, since 1960, a wine and spirit shop with thousands of imported and domestic wines and spirits, and staff for questions and advice, 845-336-6155. And Mass Bliss Festival, July 10th through the 12th in the Berkshires, a camping festival with live music, theater, and workshops in yoga and meditation, massbliss.com for schedule.
Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to the panel discussion this morning. Roundtable at WAMC.org. For your input, we'd love to hear from you. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Okay, it took him 6 years, but hello, Twitter. The president is on Twitter.
Mm.
He said, "It's Barack, really." That was the first. That was the first tweet. And yesterday.
It's the handle is at POTUS, President of the United States, and they say they're going to give it to the next president to That's use right. after he leaves the White House.
Now, the claim here, from what I understand in reading about this, is that It is he who writes this. It is not. It is not through, you know, a staff or it will be comments that he actually writes. The great thing about that statement is we have no way of knowing of whether that's whether that's true or not. But we assume that whatever, you know, comes out is from his mind. To me, the question here is, when I read the story, first of all, was A, really, the president didn't already have a Twitter account? And B, well, why wait 6 years?
Well, they used one during the campaign, but everything is pretty parsed when you're the president, and your access to the people themselves is usually limited. This really transcends all that if he is indeed actually real-time tweeting. Now, maybe he's writing a tweet, someone's looking at it and saying, oh, Mr. President, maybe perhaps you ought to use a different verb. That's too strong. You know, whether that's going on or whether he is allowed to do spontaneous kind of stream of consciousness tweeting, which could be fascinating. You know, if he's like in some, you know, he's at Camp David with the Middle East leaders and he says, boy, these guys are really obtuse, you know, or something. And he can do that now, and he has to play by the same rules as everybody else on the Twitter sphere. And if he says the wrong thing, he's going to regret it.
Yeah, it's really too bad that George W. didn't have this going for him, because that would have been really fascinating.
To get a stream of consciousness of George W. Bush's mind?
Yeah.
Yeah, that would have been. I should note that, you know, other world leaders have gone to Twitter. In fact, recently there was a lot of publicity about Pope Francis.
That's
is
right.
Now on Twitter. And the whole approach that the Vatican says is this is where the people are, this is where the faithful are, and this is how we have to reach them. So the same thing. If the president wants to meet the people and wants to – and this is going on in all the political campaigns. All the candidates are using Twitter and Facebook and other social media techniques to bypass the established news media and go directly to the people, and it can be more effective. And if Blair pointed out, you know, with the EPA story, it doesn't cost a whole lot. So they can do it fairly inexpensively. But I know they all hire social media experts to do it, you know.
And there'll be somebody standing next to the president saying, hey, boss, maybe we could say this.
Yeah, that's well, hashtag.
I mean, you know, when you think about it, it's just another step in the evolution, right? I mean, there used to be radio addresses, then there were TV addresses, and now there's going to be commentary from the president via Twitter. I mean, it's just sort of the next phase of the interaction. And as we mentioned before in the EPA issue, it is the way to communicate directly with the public in a way that's different. And so as the society changes and the way we communicate changes, this is an example of that. Now, why it took 6 years? I mean, even Blair has a Twitter account, and I am sort of like Coco the gorilla when it comes to using technology.
With the little gorilla. Symbols, with the little symbols, right?
Yeah, because they gave Joe Biden one.
Yeah, did they take it back?
Yeah, they never did.
I mean, the question is, who is the they, right? I mean, we even said this before. I mean, who is the guy's the president of the United States. If he wants to have a Twitter account, he has a Twitter account. Who's going to tell him he can't?
Well, I mean, in his first tweet, he says, they're giving in.
Yeah, I know.
They're finally, giving
his
me
handlers,
an account.
Those people whose names we don't
He doesn't strike me as the type of guy. My guess is, you know, as we all know for dealing with Twitter, I mean, you sort of have to constantly be at it. Now, again, he's the president of the United States. People are going to follow him no matter what. I don't know if you looked at his Twitter home.
Already.
It's like
hundreds
millions.
Of thousands.
Right,
yeah, yeah.
And he'd only tweeted out three. And he was only following, when I looked at it, 65, right? So he's definitely...
Mostly colleges, universities, and family members.
And so, but to maintain sort of a presence on it means you're usually putting out a stream of commentary, and the snarkier the better, which may get him into trouble. I assume he won't do that. And it takes time. It takes time because you are trying to communicate on sort of a real-time basis. And I don't know if he has the time to do that. He has things going on, like the Ukraine and Iraq, to distract him. And he probably is not going to be one of tweeting about that.
I follow you. You're rarely snarky.
No, I don't have any followers. See, that's the difference, right?
Joe, right?
When you do make a snarky comment, that's the stuff that sort of careens around the Twitterverse. It's not this sort of basic sort of, this is, you know, like for me, it's sort of like a clipping service, right? I see these fun things, I put it out, and
pass
then I keep
along
them.
Links.
Yeah, I will point out that recently we were treated to a spate of stories about Twitter falling on the market. In other words, I believe that the stock went down. And there were people who were still saying that the reason for that is, just as you implied about the gorilla comment, is that many people don't really know how to do it. you know, my son keeps telling me that when I do it, I have to put in @AlanShartuck or a hashtag or something like that. I don't know what that's all about.
Well, there is lots of online tutorials about how to properly tweet.
Well,
and
yeah.
And there's protocols and there's a sort of a, you know, a lot of models to follow.
That is so condescending of you.
Yeah.
I mean, talk about snarky.
I think that was helpful. I don't think that was condescending.
Well, no, but it's also you, Alan, have to find the time, to go and read this stuff as if you could. You can't because you don't know about those things. And so Mike was just rubbing salt
taking
in the wounds.
I was taking
offense for a good reason because I could.
Well, I mean, you know, again, from a political perspective, I mean, the coalition that elects Democrats is really made up primarily of liberals, minorities, and young people. And the tech-savvy part of the voting electorate tend to be younger.
Right.
And so for the president to be communicating with them directly gives him a political advantage. Because, as Mike mentioned before, it is another way to communicate without going through sort of the quote-unquote mainstream media. It's a way to send your message out directly to people who don't get their information primarily from newspapers and TV anymore.
So true.
They primarily get their information in online settings, and the president's Twitter account will be one of the places they'll get it.
You're right.
Yeah, he had 217,000 new followers within 45 minutes, according to Reuters. So, you know. It's growing.
I'm a follower now.
Yes.
Yeah, well, yeah. How could you not be?
Well, I'm going to follow @POTUS, whoever the POTUS is, because I'm always interested in what the president's
saying. And you can unfollow people. So if there's a POTUS that you don't want
to
follow.
I found that out to my own horror. people, when they see the Coco's 10 thumbs have sort of made terrible mistakes, they're like, well, I can't follow this guy anymore.
Coco. You know? All right. Any other letters, Alan? You got a letter?
Yeah, sure.
We have about
a
minute and a half for a letter, too.
Here's an important one. What was the title of the song used as a music button this morning at 9:24?
It's online, WAMC.org. Go to the roundtable page, and it'll be listed there.
Okay. And then we had several about our transmission problems. We're fixing it. We're working on it all the time, every time you turn around. And then from Patrick, are the pro-gun citizens saying that the biker criminals had guns legally? Of course. Right? Of course they are. Isn't that what they're saying, that they had them?
Well, as far as we know.
Well, right, but Texas is, you know. And Pam says, before the College of St. Rose cuts the pittance they pay their people, maybe they should cut back on buying huge chunks of property and building large new buildings on all of it. They may be suffering from an edifice complex, not high staffing costs. And Barbara says, little coverage about white on white. We read that. Good morning, says Mark. It's always sad when anyone has to lose their job, but it is hard for the average person to sympathize when the cost of higher education is as high as it is. Like healthcare, the economic model for colleges and universities has to be overhauled if these institutions wish to survive. And Ted said, didn't St. Rose expand a few years ago? Does this impact their current situation? Could the panel comment? No.
Okay. And we're going to end it there. That'll be the last word. Thank you very much to Alan and Mike and Blair. Terrific to have you all here. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll be back tomorrow. You're listening to The Roundtable and WAMC.